From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, love the sinner, hate the sin. A pastor challenges Christian churches to rethink their traditional approach to gays and lesbians.
As I got to know actual gay and lesbian people as they started coming to our church, these policies just didn't fit who they were.
We get an update on the grand bargain to keep DIA treasures out of the hands of Detroit's creditors.
It would be for the first time in a century, the museum would be spun off from the city, and that's a big deal.
And pitching Detroit at the very hip South by Southwest Festival.
To hopefully convince some young entrepreneurs or creatives or investors to want to play a role in that Detroit brand and, demonstrate their grit and muscle.
We've got those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. A decision on the legal challenge to Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage is expected by the end of next week. Yes, there's certainly been much debate in federal court in Detroit about whether same-sex couples should be allowed to marry in Michigan. But what about attitudes towards homosexuals in religious institutions? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, just how open should churches be when it comes to embracing gays and lesbians? Then, prisoners in Michigan share their profound life experiences through poems, essays, and short stories. That story later this hour. But first, it was 95 years ago, and the Detroit Institute of Arts was in deep financial trouble. It kept the doors open by turning over the building and its art to the thriving city of Detroit in exchange for annual funding. Well, here it stands today, poised to flip that arrangement upside down, hoping to cut Detroit's ownership in order to protect its treasures from Detroit's hungry creditors. There's quite a long and complicated history between the DIA and the city of Detroit. Detroit Free Press writer Mark Stryker recently explored this, giving us the past, the present, and the future of the DIA's predicament. Good to have you with us, Mark.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So you kind of give us a real good sense that this so-called grand bargain, if it all comes together, kind of hits the reset button for the DIA and takes us back 95 years.
In a lot of ways, it does, because it would restore the museum to independent operations away from city ownership, and it would essentially set up an operating structure that is like every other major American museum in the country. That's one of the things that's so unique about this situation, is the DIA's ownership arrangement with the city of Detroit is unique, and it is precisely because the city technically owns the building and the art that the museum's collection finds itself in the crosshairs of creditors to begin with. So in some ways, it is both a radical and a conservative move. It would be conservative to the extent that this just is restoring the sort of normalcy that all museums have, and yet it would be radical here in Detroit, because it would be for the first time in a century, the museum would be spun off from the city, and that's a big deal.
And as you point out in your piece for the Free Press, that this does raise some, as you call them, potentially thorny issues for Detroit's political leaders.
It does. You know, the city political leaders, whose predominantly African-American constituents, you know, sort of have long feared that Detroit's financial troubles would, become a pretext for stripping the city of many of its most important assets and valuable assets, could raise a ruckus over this. They haven't as of yet, and mm-hmm. we can talk about why that is. It's very interesting.
Yes.
But it is important and interesting to remember that 20 years ago, when the museum was negotiating an operating agreement with the city, which essentially transferred daily operations of the museum from the city itself to the museum staff and its board. When that was going on 20 years ago, there were huge outcries over the possibility of the notion of the city, you know, sacrificing its greatest treasures, its crown jewels, to white interest in the suburbs. And we have heard none of that this time around. And remember, 20 years ago, we were only talking about daily operation, not actual ownership. And today we're talking about actual ownership.
Yes.
So it's a much more radical shift, and yet we've had almost no outcry to this point.
Yes, in fact, you talked to people for your story for the Free Press, and it's a pretty muted reaction. Certainly nothing like the reaction when Belle Isle was leased to the state of Michigan. So what's behind that, do you think?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. People are used to the notion of a DIA operating separate from the city. you know, people recognize that the DIA and its collection will not be leaving the city. They're prohibited by this bargain that we've been talking about from doing so. People are scared of the alternative of possibly losing the masterpieces to the highest bidder. The relief of pensioners is a much more important issue for most people, and that's baked into the plan that would effectively give the DIA its independence. And as far as Belle Isle goes, you know, that's an asset that most average Detroiters, let's say, have a closer relationship with Belle Isle than they do with the DIA. And so there was much greater concern over the possibility of losing that asset than the DIA.
I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press writer Mark Stryker, who recently explored the DIA's grand bargain in a piece for the Free Press. What's the latest on this $815 million grand bargain? It was all cobbled together by federal judge Gerald Rosen between foundations and the DIA and the state. And you're saying the paint has certainly not dried.
No, by no means. So let's remind people what this is all about. Judge Rosen has helped spearhead a $815 million rescue fund that is aimed at softening the pension cuts and at the same time would safeguard the art. What's happened is that national and local charitable foundations have pledged $365 million. The DIA itself has agreed to raise $100 million. And there is a proposal in front of the state legislature right now to match those funds with $350 million from the state, but that needs state approval. And all of that money, in effect, would funnel into pensions over the next 20 years to mitigate against the cuts that are, in fact, being proposed under Kevin Orr's plan of adjustment.
Sure, so, and this isn't saying that it would eliminate them. It would just somewhat soften the blow for the pensioners, wouldn't it?
Correct. But there's a lot that still has to be done here. The pension representatives so far have balked at the financial concessions that they're being asked, and they're balking at the management oversight that would be part of the deal. And until they agree to the $815 million that are on the table, there's no deal. At the same time, there's $350 million from the state, and there needs to be state legislative approval, and that's a political issue, and it's an election year. And even though the governor has made the proposal himself and he's lobbying his own party, there is resistance, particularly from outstate Republicans, to, in effect, feel as if they are bailing out Detroit. So you've got election year politics on the one hand. You got the pensions that are sitting there looking at $815 million and wondering, okay, is bird in the hand worth two in the bush? And, you know, they could take the money that's on the table, but they could also sort of wait and say, well, wait a minute, we've appealed the pension cuts on the grounds that pensions can't be cut due to the state constitution, and we're waiting for that. And if we win there, maybe we don't have to accept any cuts. It's not clear what would happen there, and there are many experts that think that's a long shot for them, but still there is hope. And so you've got a lot of complicated interlocking factors here and agendas, and it's we're sort of everybody's watching everybody else to see what happens, and there's no deal until everybody's in.
It kind of reminds me of a Michigan version of a House of Cards episode because
yeah,
there's
absolutely
so many pieces. And as we remember, the issue of whether pensions can be cut and whether they're protected by the Constitution, Judge Stephen Rhodes already laid down his decision on that. He said Constitution does not protect it. So that's why they're off appealing. The pension boards are off appealing that decision. So there's just so many pieces trying to fit together here.
Yes, and it really is one of these situations where, you know, nobody's in till everybody's in. And so everybody's sort of watching each other, and there's pressure being applied from all kinds of places in all kinds of ways. Meanwhile, let's remember that the DIA itself is kind of on the side here, watching all of this play out as its fate is sort of being determined in large part by others. Now, at this point, the DIA has its own lawyers at the table, and they're working out the details of how the independence would be set up. But you know, for months and months and months, the DIA was kind of on the outside looking in, watching people play with, in some ways, their irreplaceable masterpieces.
And let's not forget, as you point out in your piece, creditors have not given up hopes of getting something out of the DIA. They're kind of circling around waiting for what?
Well, this is absolutely the other big unanswered question is the creditors are looking at what are billions of dollars worth of art in the museum and saying, you can't leave all that on the table. Essentially, you know, what Kevin Orr in his plan of adjustment and what this grand bargain has done is it's basically said, okay, we have $815 million that we are going to put into the pot on behalf of the museum. We're covering the museum with $815 million. And the creditors are saying, whoa, wait a minute. There's a lot more money worth of art in the museum, and we should have access to that. And so that's the argument they're going to make in court, and it will be up to Judge Stephen Rhodes to decide whether or not, in fact, $815 million covers enough of the art that he will allow that, or, in fact, if that isn't fair and doesn't represent what the art is worth. And that gets into questions of whether or not the judge even thinks that the art can be sold or monetized or not. And that's a whole other set of legal questions. So, again, on that front, you've got a lot of unanswered questions, too.
Detroit Free Press writer Mark Stryker, thank you so much for the great putting it all in perspective exercise for us with the DIA grand bargain. Thank you so much, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The very hip South by Southwest Festival is happening right now in Austin, Texas. This is where the cutting edge of music, technology, and new thinking all come together. And it's where my next guest has been busily pitching Detroit to all these creative types. Earlier this week, he hosted a session called We're Moving to Detroit, and So Should You. Ian Lanovich is the digital creative director of Low Campbell Ewald, and he joins us now from Austin. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Cynthia.
So your message at South by Southwest is?
It's basically that when you look at Detroit as a brand, not every city has a brand, but Detroit does. And unlike the ones that do, with Detroit, right now you literally have the opportunity to play an active role in shaping that brand's future.
And you took your message and turned it into a creative project that kind of seemed to be centered on a video. Tell us what's in that video and how you wound up getting invited to bring it to South by Southwest.
Well, it was about a week after Detroit declared bankruptcy. We had recently just made the decision to move our office into downtown Detroit. So I was talking with my PR team, and we were talking about South by Southwest, and we thought it would be a good idea to explain the story around why we're moving our company into the heart of a city that just filed for bankruptcy. So I put that video out, and within 24 hours of it being online, and we hadn't even shared it yet, all of a sudden a Miami reporter contacted me. Huh. And so it basically said that there was an interesting conversation happening on his Facebook wall about my video. And I took a look at it, and there was already 50-plus comments.
Wow, that's fast.
And over the course of the next week, I think there was 20,000 views in the first week, and then it just started to spike. And the scene that really reached out to me the most was the entrepreneur scene. And I've never been an entrepreneur, so I basically reached back, you know, and started setting up meetings with various venture capitalists and, you know, startups. Just getting to know the scene, various accelerators and incubators. And we actually ended up making the decision a week ago to onboard our first startup into Low Campbell Ewald by investing in them with space and access to creative and strategic resources.
So I'm curious, is there a certain type of person or company that you hope to draw to Detroit or you think would be a good fit for that Detroit brand? And is that why you went to South by Southwest?
Yeah, I just want to, you know, there's obviously, everybody knows the negative story about Detroit. I mean, it's been told over and over and over and over and over again.
Ad nauseum.
Right, and you can just run a search and find that. And I think that's why my video was actually so well received, because it was the one piece of positive in a sea of negative. And what I've seen as I've immersed myself into the Detroit scene over the last year is everybody seems to be working to a higher purpose. You know, they're trying to start their business, they're trying to figure out the tricks of the trade, they're trying to generate revenue, but they also are trying to define the city's future, which my next point is anyone's success is everyone's success. You know, so it almost feels more collaborative than competitive. And there's one guy in particular, David Anderson. He's the founder of Bamboo Detroit, which is one of the newer co-working spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I was meeting with him one day, and he was leaving to go to another meeting at another co-working space called Grand Circus. And I just asked him the question, isn't that your competitor? And he goes, we try not to think of it that way. We meet regularly so that we could define a world where we can coexist.
Well, there's a change.
Right. And that's very different than, you know, most cultures, most business culture. So I'm looking for people that basically want to challenge. You know, they want to actually do something, you know, meaningful, you know, and support the city as well as, you know, support their own career.
Lo Campbell Ewald moved to Detroit after many, many, many years in Warren out near the GM Tech Center. How has that experience informed the message that you're presenting?
I think it's we practice what we preach. So when we first put out the video, we hadn't been, you know, working in the city yet. And now we have for a few months. And definitely within the workforce, I haven't really heard any negative comments about it. Everybody's been, it's been very positive. You know, obviously I-75 can get a little bit of a struggle once in a while, but outside of that, you know, everyone's just kind of becoming part of the community.
Ian Lanovich is the Digital Creative Director at Lo Campbell Ewald. He hosted the We're Moving to Detroit and So Should You session that happened this week at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. Thanks for taking time to talk with us, Ian.
Thank you very much.
Just because you've been found guilty of a crime and you've been sentenced to prison doesn't mean that you no longer have a voice, an opinion, something to say. And that's why each year the Prison Creative Arts Project puts out the call to incarcerated persons who are in prisons all over Michigan. Send us your poetry, your essays, your short stories. PCAP goes through each submission and chooses the work to go into its annual Michigan Review of Prisoner Creative Writing. They're about to release their sixth volume. This one is called The Sky is on Fire After All. I'm joined now by Philip Christman, who edits the review, and he's an English department instructor at the University of Michigan. Very good to have you with us, Phil.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we welcome Lee Sugar, who is the assistant editor of the Michigan Review of Prisoner Creative Writing. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Can you give me an idea of a piece that really grabbed your heart?
Well, the title of the volume comes from a piece by a guy named Chris Dankovich, who's, you know, we've taken his work before because he's really, really good. The Sky is on Fire after All is a line from his piece. And it's basically something that if I were teaching creative writing, I would tell people never to do, which is it's a description of a bunch of dreams. And you tell people on the first day of any workshop, you know, you get one dream sequence all semester, if that many, right? They tend to be inherently boring. But the way he narrates it and the way he strings together the dream world and real life worlds, he's kind of developed this sort of homegrown surrealism that's really appealing. And the, you know, you asked about themes just mm-hmm. within the journal. And one thing that did come up again and again in that piece that I talk about in my editor's note is that a sense of horrible apocalyptic things going on at the same time as like boring quotidian life is going on. A lot of the work we get reflects, tries to do something with that binary.
In that 24-hour span of a day in prison.
Right.
It's, as you say, as boring as could be, and then it's post-apocalyptic nightmare.
Yeah.
Lee, what has been the most rewarding part of helping put together this journal of stories from Michigan's prisoners?
Shuffling through submissions is just incredible, seeing the range of work that we get. And the other thing that's really exciting for me is planning the book release events where we get to meet the family and friends of the writers. And it's so wonderful to get to speak with someone's mother or mm-hmm. husband or wife on the phone and say, you know, your loved one's writing was selected out of 300 and we want you to read it at this event.
This has to be a very big experience for the writers and for their loved ones.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in creating the journal yet, but I knew that I would be. And I came to last year's book release event, which Lee was also, I think, mm-hmm. primarily responsible for. And it was incredibly moving. I mean, to see people who right at that moment as they are reading this person's poem, they are missing that person, you know, because, you know, people who have family members or friends in prison, I mean, you feel that absence constantly.
Do you ever get a sense that there is some tension or a perception that what this work is about glorifies prisoners and what they've done?
Well, first of all, the range of anyone picking up this volume will be shocked at how little of the work actually talks directly about how people wound up in the clutches of the legal system. What work does talk about that is often written with in a tone of sort of, you know, Johnny Cashian regret, you know. This is the centenary of the birth of William Burroughs, who, you know, killed his wife during a heroin-soaked game of William Tell and very likely would have wound up, brought up for manslaughter if he hadn't fled the country. There's a new biography of Norman Mailer, who, you know, of course, stabbed his wife. No one gets through grad school in English without reading the French Marxist theorist Louis Althusser, who straight up strangled his wife for no reason. I mean, we are already reading. I mean, work by people who have done amazingly bad things is already respected and glorified. The only difference, you know, and of course, some of those folks that I just mentioned were dealing with addiction and mental health issues. Well, guess who else is dealing with addiction and mental health issues?
The very people who are in Michigan's prisons.
Correct. So I don't see a huge distinction between celebrating that work and celebrating this work.
The Sky is on Fire, after all, is going to be published in March, and it'll be launched with readings in Detroit and in Ann Arbor. And you can go to prisonarts.org to find out more. That's prisonarts.org. And we have been talking to the editor of the Michigan Review of Prisoner Creative Writing, Phil Christman, and the assistant editor, Lee Sugar. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of Michigan's contributions to the world of comedy is Haywood Banks. Whether he's playing his guitar or his trusty toaster, he's made the audiences laugh all over the country. He's appeared on A&E, MTV, Entertainment Tonight. He was the MC at the 2012 Ann Arbor Folk Festival, and he's playing at the Ark in Ann Arbor on March 15th. Haywood Banks, good to have you on Stateside.
It's just great to be here.
You know, I have seen reviewers try and, may I say, struggle to describe your comedy style. Tell me, how would you describe it?
Well, I didn't form my style around other comics. So it's just, I started out as a folk singer. And just to kind of introduce songs, I would, you know, try and tell funny things or make up stuff. A lot of the stuff I do, it might be wordplay or, you know, just, I don't know. It's all over the place. There's no, I can't describe it. So
there, you can't
either.
There
we go.
Well, it's interesting. You have always stayed home here in Southeast Michigan. Was that a conscious decision? Did it just happen? Because a lot of folks pick up sticks and head to either coast.
Well, I had a lot of success here in Michigan and Indiana, Ohio, and there's a radio show called The Bob and Tom Show that's in 150 markets around the country. And, of course, The Jim Harper Show and being on Young Country here and Dick Purton. And, you know, it's like there's just such great radio here that I was able to make a living and, you know, stay somewhat close to home. So just kind of worked out that way.
Were you able to drive your comedy career the way you wanted to, staying in Michigan?
I think pretty much.
Certainly is a help.
Oh yeah. I used to be able to sell a lot more CDs than I do now. But
free downloads on the internet.
Yeah, the CDs have taken a nosedive since about 2002 or three or something like that. And you know, for any kind of musician or any kind of recorded thing, it immediately went on the internet. And whether it was Napster or just, you know, iTunes or something, you know, people can just, you know, go and download the stuff and, you know, so they don't need CDs anymore.
Now, I have seen your comedy show. I saw you play at Ridley's in Royal Oak. And as I remember the show, you're funny without resorting to profanity. And was that a conscious decision early on, or did that work the best for you so you decided I don't have to do what Chris Rock does?
Well, I like I said, I started out as a folk singer,
yeah.
and nobody ever sang Puff the Blankety Blank Magic Dragon, you know, so it was just, you know, it didn't occur to me to actually do that. And when my kids were little, they wanted to come and see my show. So it's like it was an easy transition that, you know, my 4 and 7-year-old kids, you know, could come and see me. So, you know, it wasn't really – a lot of people think it's some kind of miracle that you can – that they're still capable of laughing and nobody's talking, you know
– talking trash.
Not swearing or, you know, or saying, you know, two crazy things. I mean, there's a whole world of stuff to talk about. And people bring their kids to my show. It's not a kid's show. I always say mm-hmm. it's an adult show you can bring kids to. But it's just incidentally, you know, there's no swearing or, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. So
now you have a new CD called Dear Calamity Jane. It's a change of pace for you.
Well, that is a my wife Shirley is a songwriter, and she is a lyricist, and we put together like a folky album,
mm-hmm.
and I put all the lyrics, or I put the music to the lyrics and sang the songs, and you know it's fun to have a change of pace and to kind of get back to some folk roots. And a friend of mine, David Mosier, played all the music on it. And you know, there's some great talent here in Southeast Michigan.
But you are going to be really doing the comedy side of things when you're at the Arc on this Saturday.
Yeah.
And, of course, having just endured one more nasty blast of winter, I think it's appropriate that we listen to your song Wiper Blades, because it's all on our minds this week.
Great. Winter's here with all the ice and snow, and the surly slush upon the road. The salty spray upon my window makes me wish that I'd replace my wiper blades. My whipper, whipper, whipper blades. My whipper, whipper, whipper blades. My whipper, whipper, whipper blades. I wish that I'd replace my wiper blades. Salty spray from semis that do pass, they turn my windshield into bathroom glass. I turn the knob, but I come to the conclusion that I did not fill up my washer solution. My whipper, whipper, whipper fluid. Come on, somebody. My whipper, whipper, whipper fluid. My whipper, whipper, whipper fluid. I wish that I'd replace my wiper fluid. Down the expressway, 80 mph. I can make out headlights, taillights, frosted shapes. But down by the dash is a clearing where both blades do scrape. I can see fine if I lay on the passenger seat. My whipper, whipper, whipper blades. Come on. My whipper, whipper, whipper blades.
Anybody with a Mercedes? Here we go. My Viper, Viper, Viper blade. I wish that I replaced my Viper blade.
One time on delay. My whipper. Whipper blades. I wish that I'd replace my wiper blades.
On delay, on delay.
Amen. Haywood Banks. His website is haywoodbanks.com. And by the way, that's HEYWOOD, not HAY. So haywoodbanks.com. He will be at the Arc on March 15th. And if you think of him every time you make your morning breakfast toast, you know the reason why. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you
Stateside.
So much. It's so great to see you again.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There can be little doubt we're living at a time when our attitudes as a society are undergoing a tremendous shift in what we think of individuals who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered. For example, gay marriage. The most recent Michigan State University survey found 54% of Michiganders support gay marriage, 36% oppose it. That's the view from social science. What about the view from the pulpit? Ken Wilson is pastor of Vineyard Church of Ann Arbor. He has spent years wrestling with the question, where do we as a Christian faith community draw the line on the gay issue? His journey to rethinking his beliefs about where LGBT people fit into what he calls the company of Jesus is spelled out in his new book, A Letter to My Congregation, An Evangelical Pastor's Path to Embracing People Who Are Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender into the Company of Jesus. Ken, welcome to the program. This is actually a huge, long letter written to your congregation at Vineyard Church. And your message to your congregation about gays and lesbians and transgendered persons is what?
My message is essentially that I'm not able, as the lead pastor, to enforce the traditional exclusionary policies. So this has been the received tradition in my tradition as an evangelical Christian, and really has been part of the Christian consensus for centuries, mm-hmm. that gay and lesbian people either shouldn't be members or they should be disqualified from leadership or various versions of exclusionary policies. And as I got to know actual gay and lesbian people as they started coming to our church, these policies just didn't fit who they were.
And also you were so influenced by parents,
yes.
in your congregation who came to you, and it seems to be in increasing numbers.
Yes. And I found it quite interesting that I hadn't had a single – so I'm a founding pastor. The church started in our living room in 1975. Mm-hmm. And we're now, you know, between 500 and 600 on a Sunday. And so that's like, what, 30-some years of ministry. And I hadn't had a single parent come to me to talk about their child wrestling with sexuality issues until I had begun the process of rethinking this and gotten to a point where I was seriously rethinking the traditional consensus. So, and then within the space of maybe 18 months, I had 6 parents come to me. Parents who have a gay child, mm-hmm. Who have faith convictions, are in a tortured position because they're often forced to choose between loving and fully accepting their child, and it's their child.
Which everything as a parent tells you you want to do.
Right, or faithfully embracing their faith tradition. And faith for people is very – that's at the core of a person's being. It's as close as sexuality is mm-hmm. in the human psyche. And so parents are in a tortured position when this happens.
What did it for you? What began that process? And it was not overnight. You make it
right.
very clear in your book that you wrestled with this thing for a long time. But what did it for you?
2 things, I would say. I developed a friendship with Phyllis Tickle, who was the founding religion editor for Publishers Weekly and is probably the leading secular expert on the religious landscape. And herself a devout, ardent Christian. Mm-hmm. And I developed a friendship with her. She invited me and my late wife, Nancy, and our daughter, Grace, to visit her home in outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And she and her husband were going to a Southern gay church where like 90% of the participants were gay or lesbian or cross-dressers or transvestite mm-hmm. or hermaphrodites, and this was Southern gay people. This was not elite, you know, mm-hmm. metropolitan
New York
region
City.
People.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
and there were bullets, you know, on the wall of the church because there had been drive-by shootings. And, you know, I went to the service with, like, what's this going to be like? And as soon as the worship started, it was like, oh, my God. The love of God is in this room, and the Holy Spirit is here, and it kind of rocked my world. I did a lot of rethinking theologically and biblically and came to see that, you know, the church has, after the rise of the divorce rate post-World War II, mm-hmm. the church was inundated with divorced and remarried people. And if you read what the Bible teaches, and especially the teaching of Jesus on divorce and remarriage— there are no really clear, legitimate grounds for remarriage after divorce except the death of a spouse. And what's at stake with remarriage is adultery. And not just one-time adultery, mm-hmm. but a continuing state of adultery. If you take the teaching of Jesus in the plain sense.
Well, I see right here when the quote that is in Matthew, he says, quote, "I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery." So you've got how many people who have divorced,
right.
have remarried,
yes.
and are welcomed into their church, their faith congregations.
And I know fellow Vineyard pastors who are divorced and remarried, and I have had board members who are divorced and remarried, and it was never a second thought. And I'm thinking, am I just making pastoral accommodations for remarried people because it's the right thing to do. It's the loving thing to do. To not do so would be to create harm.
Not to slam the door in their face.
Yeah.
Yet not extending that same
Not extending sense that of... to gay and lesbian people. And I realized, you know, when push comes to shove, you can have a successful evangelical church without gay and lesbian people because it's not that big a portion of the population. But you cannot have a successful evangelical church and not embrace people who are remarried. And is that what's really driving this thing? And when I saw that and I came to grips with that, my conscience was just, it was just like a sitting on a saddle with a thorn between me and my bottom.
Mm-mm-mm.
And it wouldn't go away.
And it seems you were afraid of what you were realizing.
Of course.
This is really talk about pushed out of your comfort zone.
Right. Since the rise of the religious right, which really was organized around the issue of homosexuality, was not organized around the abortion issue, as many people think. It was homosexuality that precipitated the moral majority. Mm-hmm. And since the rise of the religious right and its pervasive influence on Roman Catholicism and evangelicalism, which are the two main forms of Christianity in the United States and in the world, this has become like the litmus test for orthodoxy. Where you stand on the gay issue is more important than like whether you accept the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene mm-hmm. Creed, whether you love Jesus, love the Bible. And that is just crazy. I mean, that's a kind of a controversial context which is so fear-riddled. And, you know, I would say it's demonic. I would say it has an influence on people that is anti-human. It puts pressure on pastors that's anti-human. And it keeps us from just being good pastors to the gay and lesbian people who are coming our way.
I'm speaking with Ken Wilson, who's pastor of Vineyard Church of Ann Arbor. His book is called A Letter to My Congregation, An Evangelical Pastor's Path to Embracing People Who Are Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender into the Company of Jesus. And I'm wondering if I could ask you to read us a passage from your book, Ken. And it kind of is, you're setting out why you felt you needed to make this adjustment in your attitude and share with your congregation.
Right. This is on page 5. This, more than anything else, is my concern. The underlying assumption behind any exclusionary policy has to do with belonging. It's a little too brazen, ugly actually, to say out loud, but the assumption is they, the excluded people, don't belong here. If it's not the assumption, it is the effect. The question of belonging is the question addressed by the gospel. I am not willing to simply leave this question in the realm of unexamined assumptions, because it has to do with the very heart of the gospel, who belongs, and how do they belong? Romans 1:6, and you also are among the Gentiles who belong to Christ Jesus Christ. The gospel is an exciting experiment in belonging, and belonging is the deepest ache in the human heart. You can notice it most acutely when you don't have it. The Gentiles, those outside of the covenant between God and Israel, didn't have it. And then they did, through the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. Over 4 decades of pastoral ministry, I got started early, you make mistakes. But the mistakes you most regret are the ones that obscure the gospel and hurt the people you love by saying, in effect, you do not belong to those for whom Christ died to provide a place of belonging. I've made such mistakes in the past. I'll tell you about some, but only in an effort not to repeat them. I've written this lengthy letter to you, my congregation, to address this matter. Others may listen in, but I'm writing to discharge my responsibility to you as best I can, fearing him to whom I will give an account.
That's Ken Wilson, pastor of Vineyard Church. And Ken, I'm going to read from a typical comment after a published interview that journalist David Crum did with you, because it's clear that you know there are people out there who will hear what you're saying and feel that you are dreadfully, terribly mistaken. This woman wrote, I'll quote her now, "I'm very tired of hearing people say that Christians hate gays just because we take a stance against sin. It's not about hating them. It's about loving their soul. I want them to be set free, and I want them to be in heaven, not in hell. You cannot continue in this sin or any other and make it to heaven." Would you have written those words 10 years ago?
I probably wouldn't have written those words 10 years ago, but I certainly would be in a lot of connection with a lot of people who would stand by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I might not have written against those words. I would have had my private concerns about them. But, you know, there is a deep tradition in the Western Christian tradition that views homosexuality very, very negatively. You know, Thomas Aquinas, the great doctor of the church, said that homosexuality is worse than incest morally, and it's worse than rape. He said it was worse than rape. So there's a deep tradition in the church that is really has a strong aversion to homosexuality. And you know, coming to grips with this, learning about this, studying this, and saying, well, wait a minute, what does this have to do with the gay people I know, was really crucial for me.
How was your letter received by your congregation?
No, I think people knew that I was wrestling with this question for quite a while. They heard things in sermons. I didn't treat it directly, but mm-hmm. they wondered. So I got a nudge while I was doing a meditation on Psalm 23 to write a letter to my congregation. So that's what I did. And after I was finished with it, it ended up being about 80 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let people know, hey, I've written this to you. If you want a copy, send me an email. You have to read the whole thing, though. Hear me out. And I think we might have had about 200, 220 people who asked for the letter. And amazingly, I didn't get much negative pushback from people. I think people understood the process, but they know me.
Mm-hmm.
If they're part of our church community, they have some level of trust in me.
Do you feel that you've been able to change minds and hearts?
I've had, you know, when you engage in a process like mm-hmm. this, you're afraid. And so your brain tends to focus on all the people who disagree with you. And there certainly have been people right. in my congregation who've disagreed with me.
Have you had people leave?
Oh, yeah. We've had people leave. We've had, you know, major contributors leave.
Okay.
We've had, you know, very dear friends mm-hmm. leave. But I've had a lot of people say, you know, I was on the fence on this. I didn't really know what to think. I saw things very differently. You really got me thinking. I'd say a lot of people would say, I really appreciate your process, and I appreciate your wrestling with it. I'm not sure I can agree with all of your conclusions, but I think this is a really legitimate conversation that we need to have. And that's all I'm interested in.
Start the conversation.
Start the conversation.
With perhaps an element of compassion.
Yeah, exactly. And as we have more gay people in our congregation, these are real human beings and who are known and who are loved.
Now, I'm curious about reactions from other evangelical leaders.
Right. Me too. I think so far I'm in the honeymoon phase because after all, the book's titled A Letter to My Congregation, An Evangelical Pastor's Path to Embracing People Who Are Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender into the Company of Jesus. So there are going to be a lot of evangelicals who see the subtitle and say, I have no interest in reading this book.
Not opening the book.
Right.
Yeah.
So my initial responses are from people who are open-minded, and they're terrific. And, you know, I'm getting great response from my fellow Vineyard pastors, even though my denomination has kind of reinforced a traditional exclusionary approach on this issue, partly in response to the fact that I've presented this material at our scholarly society.
But you've got a big ally that's stepping up.
Right. I have a big ally. I had met David Gushee several years ago in my work on evangelical environmental concern.
And he is?
And he is a leading ethicist in the evangelical world. So his book, Kingdom Ethics, would be a textbook that would be used in a lot of ethics courses in the top evangelical seminaries. Fuller uses it. It's probably the most popular ethics text.
So he's leaving his imprint on future ministers and pastors.
He is taking a big risk. He's published on this topic before, reinforcing the traditional consensus, and he's reversing his perspective on it, and he's doing that by writing the foreword to my book. And, you know, I'm sure he'll have speaking engagements that will be canceled, and I'm sure he won't be called up perhaps by Christianity Today to, you know, okay. take a quote about from a Christian ethicist, because he'll be, you know, he'll be viewed askance, and so yeah, he's a good person, and he's a powerful ally.
Finally, Ken, what do you fear would be the repercussions for Christian congregations if leaders in churches don't tackle this question?
Well, I mean, we're now at the point, maybe 10 years ago, a pastor didn't have to, like, take a stand on this issue or suffer the consequences of his or her stand. But now, because of how this has arisen in the national conversation, mm-hmm. whatever you do, you are going to suffer the consequences as a pastor. So if you continue the exclusionary policies, there are people who will not even come to your church. And I'm not just talking about gay and lesbian mm-hmm. people, but people who don't want to come into an environment where they're going to be taught to love the sin, but you know, love the sinner, mm-hmm. but hate the sin, and that person is their daughter or their sister. And on the other hand, if we don't find a way to make space for gay and lesbian people who are loved, we're losing the millennial generation. Young people are leaving the church at an unprecedented rate, and it's happening in evangelical churches, not quite as precipitously, but it's happening. And so there's a lot at stake over this issue for the church.
Ken Wilson is the pastor of Vineyard Church of Ann Arbor. His book is A Letter to My Congregation, An Evangelical Pastor's Path to Embracing People Who Are Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender into the Company of Jesus. Thank you so much for joining us, Ken.
My pleasure.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe out there in this winter storm.